Before we get started, I just wanted to thank you guys for coming back for another episode of The Places You'll Go. If you enjoy the podcast and want to get involved in the community or take a guess at our weekly photo teasers, like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at ThePlacesYG. If you have your own amazing stories to tell us, feedback about the show, or ideas for upcoming episodes, feel free to email us at theplacesyg@gmail.com or visit anchor.fm/theplacesyg to leave us a text or voice message. Finally, if you want more people to find out about how awesome this show is, follow us on Spotify and Overcast and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. Now, without further ado, enjoy this week's episode.
This is a Wandering Hippies production.
Hello.
Hi.
Let's go. Back to the Great Plains, shall we?
Nah. No, I'm good.
Well,
too bad.
So you're catching us on a good night. We've had a few.
But not as much as last time.
No, last time we were not in a great shape.
It was late.
So late. This time we went on a little date night. We went up to Golden, got some chocolates at a little chocolate store. Super cute little place. Golden Sweets. If you ever go to Golden, Colorado. Colorado. Sorry, I said it wrong.
What did you say, Colorado?
Yeah, I said Colorado. And then we went to Morrison, Colorado, and that's where Red Rocks is. We went to a little restaurant there in Morrison, and that was a lot of fun. Had a few beers and some good-ish food.
Yeah.
I'm not going to knock them because I'm not going to plug them, so...
Yeah.
Because I don't know that it was worth plugging on the show. Golden Sweets is worth it.
Golden Sweets? Holy moly, y'all. They're sitting right next to me, and I am having the hardest time not eating them. I just keep staring at them.
They're not even next to me, and I want to open them and eat another. But anyway, the restaurant we were going to go to in Morrison was closed because there's a snowstorm tonight. They're getting like 10 inches in Morrison. We're going to get like 8 here in Arvada. So, a lot of places weren't open that we were going to go to. We were going to go to a barcade that had already closed for the evening.
And guys, I just want to say, we're not upset. We're really happy.
No, I understand.
That they could close. They put their people first, which, what's that like?
Most companies don't. Neither of the companies we work for do. So.
No.
But it is what it is.
Yeah. Yours is a little different, though, because your hospitality.
Fuck them.
Okay. Fuck them.
Fuck them hotel guests.
It's not different. Not different at all.
Yeah, but we stopped at a little brewery up in Westminster, had a couple more beers, and decided to swing on back home. It's slow going right now because the roads are not in great shape.
Yeah, it did. It took us almost an hour to get home.
It took us an hour from Morrison to...
Yeah.
Westminster, which should have been more like 30-ish minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're home safe. We are now ready for the next episode, the next installment in The Places You'll Go in Season 3.
Ready for the next episode. Hey. Shout out to Super Bowl Halftime if you don't like it.
Yeah, go fuck yourself.
You're racist or you're old. Or you don't like rap.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like even people... Like, I'm not... I like some rap, but I'm not really into rap. But I could still... I mean, that's the shit we grew up on, man. If you're a millennial or a Xennial, or even a Gen Xer, like... Fucking Dre, Snoop, Eminem, Mary J. Oh. Like, that's the shit we grew up on.
Yeah.
You know? So, there was a lot of nostalgia in that halftime show. We were both very happy with it. Yes. And if you didn't like it, then get over yourself and move on with your life.
You're not going to like this podcast.
You're not going to like this podcast, so just stop listening. Sorry.
Bye.
Anyway, we're going to go a little further south in the Great Plains than we did last time, but that doesn't mean it's going to be any warmer than Nebraska. So bundle up. We are headed to Wildcat Country. That's Lakin.
And that's Chance.
And these are the places you'll go.
Did I do that right? The places you'll go.
So this week, we are headed to Manhattan. But forget about the flashing lights, Times Square, or the Empire State Building. We're in Manhattan, Kansas, the home of Kansas State University, and therefore the Kansas State Wildcats. This college town, or this college has one of my favorite fight songs in all the country, and that's the Wabash Cannonball, which goes a little something like this. Okay, I'm done.
We gotta put a clip in there, right? Right? Am I wrong? Or?
It's probably copyrighted. I don't know.
That's not.
No.
That weird harmonica mouth thing that you just said.
It was a trumpet.
Oh, I'm sorry. It sounds like harmonica to me.
You can't tell with a trumpet? Duh.
Idiot.
Oh, okay. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. Manhattan, Kansas does lean into their name, being the same as the New York borough, because its nickname is actually the Little Apple.
Yes.
And they even have an apple on their flag.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, they sure do, which I thought was pretty cool.
That is cool.
But now let's get into the history of this area, because it actually is pretty fascinating. Sometime around 7000 BCE, the first immigrants from Asia arrived in what would one day be called Kansas, where they coexisted with mammoths, giant ground sloths, and camels.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Isn't it?
You just showed me a picture of a giant ground sloth.
Yes, in comparison to a human, yeah. They were big boys.
I'd still kiss it, hoping that it wouldn't eat my head off.
I don't think it would, because they were herbivores, but... You never know. Defense mechanisms.
That's what I'm saying.
Maybe they just pop your little human head off just so you don't eat him.
Maybe not eat it, but just like, yeah, bite it off.
Yeah. During this time, Paleo Indians became incredibly skilled hunters of the megafauna of this area. So skilled, in fact, that this resulted in the Pleistocene overkill, wherein nearly all of the megafaunal species that were endemic to this area were killed off. So that is why we don't still have camels in North America. We don't still have giant ground sloths.
What? They killed things off?
Yeah, it's
was
crazy.
Was it us?
It was 100,000% us.
Was it me, Jesus?
Not you specifically, but somewhere along the line your ancestors contributed.
Not you, Judas. Not you, Judas, this one time.
As a note, this overkill was also the beginning of what is known as the Holocene mass extinction event that is still actively taking place, wherein a large majority of the species that existed when humans came on the scene are no longer here, and a lot of the reason that they're no longer here is that we hunted them to extinction because they could not reproduce fast enough to keep up with the rate at which we were killing them off for our own consumptive purposes. So, I mean, take that for what it's worth, I suppose. Yeah. At the end of the day, we can certainly romanticize the people who came long before us as living a simpler life. But the fact of the matter was, they too
had a hand.
Overkilled, did not use the land in the way that it should have been used.
Well, God gave us animals to eat.
Yeah. And now there's not going to be any more. Anyway. The lack of megafaunal species to hunt led people in this area to becoming hunter-gatherers and generalists rather than specialists like they had been. Within a few thousand years, agriculture developed in the area, but was rather lethargic due to the harsh environment, and permanent settlements or permanent agriculture just really never took off on the Great Plains in Kansas.
They were like, well, it's just... You know, let's just roll this stuff up and give it to animals.
I'm sorry, what?
You know, like straw?
They didn't really even do that.
No, what do they have there?
Well, so...
We'll get into it.
Early peoples didn't do a lot of growing any crops. the handful of crops that they did grow would have been fruits, or not fruits, but vegetables to feed themselves.
Got it.
Yeah. They did not domesticate really any livestock for the most part. But this lack of agriculture really taking off led to the development of the more recent plains nations that we are familiar with, like the Pawnee, and one which we have not yet discussed, the Kanza or Ka Nation. This nation arrived in the area that would eventually be called Manhattan sometime in the late 1600s or early 1700s. As I mentioned, because agriculture was not a big thing, the typical plains nations that we learned about in textbooks as children, as, you know, being relatively semi-nomadic, following the bison herds, stuff like that. The reason they did that is because this was just not a great environment to grow stuff. The Ka were very close relatives with the Osage Nation, who also arrived in modern-day Kansas around the same time. They were all descendants of the Quapaw people who left the Ohio River Valley, likely due to pressure from other migrating nations during the early times of European incursion. The Ka broke off from the other five nations near the central Missouri and settled in northwest Missouri and northeast Kansas shortly after that split. The first mention of the five, and bear with me on this because I could not find a great pronunciation of this, but it's spelled D-H-E-G-I-H-A, so Degya Nations, of which the Ka were one of those five, came when a French explorer, Perry Marquette, drew a map showing them in their historic locations.
So I found, like, the English to, like, the native translation is pretty much, like, straightforward.
For the most part, they are. But even, like, this, like, it depends on, were the origins French? Were the origins English? Were the origins Spanish? Like, if the origin was different, then it was pronounced differently.
Right.
Because it wasn't the name they gave themselves.
Right, yeah. Of course.
And the name that they gave themselves, like, for the Ka specifically, their language is dead.
Yeah.
Like, there's no native speakers of it. There are people who know how to speak it, but there's no native speakers anymore. And then another Frenchman by the name of Bergmont was the first European to document an interaction with the Ka in 1724, around the area that would eventually become Manhattan. However, the single most influential event on the Ka Nation was the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. Prior to that, the Ka had lived on their own lands in territory that was in technicality, you know, quote-unquote owned by the French. Mm-hmm. But the French did nothing in this territory. I mean, other than, like, trapping and trading and stuff like that, like, they weren't colonizing anything at that point, at least in the Louisiana Purchase.
Right.
After the United States purchased the Louisiana Territory, the Ka became pressured by other nations who were fleeing westward American expansion and by Europeans who coveted the fertile lands that they called home, because despite the fact that the Ka understood, to their understanding, this land was not hospitable for agriculture.
Right.
Europeans were planning to grow things that the Ka did not grow. So, like, wheat, barley, corn, those things could be grown in this land, but those were not things that the Ka were familiar with.
Right.
Unfortunately, they really had nowhere to go because their enemies, the Pawnee, were directly to the north, and the Cheyenne and Comanche, who were incredibly aggressive nations, were directly to the west. And they were aggressive for understandable reasons because anybody heading west, in their eyes, was going to be an enemy in the future. And, yeah, I mean, they weren't wrong.
No.
In 1825, the Ka ceded a massive tract of land to the United States in exchange for protection and an annuity of $3,500 a year for 20 years, which, when it actually even arrived, was usually extremely late. So, per usual, we did not hold up our end of that bargain for the most part.
Weird.
Yeah. Real shocker if you understand and recognize American history at all. You're going to understand that it's not in any way truly surprising that we didn't hold up our end of the bargain with the indigenous peoples of our country. But, you know, we don't want to go into critical race theory or anything.
Oh, yeah. No.
Scary.
We don't want our youth. Ooh. We don't want our youth learning that stuff.
Yeah, we don't want our youth to know that we fucked everybody over throughout all of history.
Like we said, if you didn't like the Super Bowl halftime show, you weren't going to like this.
You're not going to like this podcast.
Now's your time.
Yeah. Actually, it's too late now.
It's too late.
You've already heard what we have to say.
You're indoctrinated.
We've brainwashed you into a liberal snowflake. Anyway, after two smallpox epidemics and a split in the nation over whether or not to work with the United States, the Ka were left fractured and much smaller in numbers. And then a massive flood hit in 1844, destroying the fields that the Ka had planted and leaving them both desperate and broke. After this, they sold all but 256,000 acres of their 2.3 million to the United States, and the Council Grove Reservation was established in Kansas. They faced a plethora of hardships during this time, from continued pressure from colonizers who wanted what little fertile land actually existed on the reservation, because in truth, the U.S. left them with the shittiest tract of land that you could possibly imagine in all of the state of Kansas.
Do you, okay, so like for once, is that on purpose or did they know?
No, it was very specifically because, so the idea was that settlers, quote unquote settlers, mm-hmm. colonizers wouldn't want to take more of the Ka land because it was bad land. So there, that was the idea, despite, but like US, the U.S. government also didn't look at the converse side of that as we're putting them on shitty, swampy land that can't be used for anything, so that they become, they're now going, or maybe they did recognize that, I don't know, because then the Ka became completely dependent on U.S. aid.
Yeah.
And stood, there was no ability for them to ever fight back against colonization, right, or reduction in size of their reservation. So, I don't know, maybe it was by design. But officially, the idea was that American colonizers moving west would have no interest in the land because it wasn't fertile or hospitable for them to settle on.
Right.
So give it to the Ka so the settlers would leave them alone. But, you know, because people are great.
Right.
We still, many, many people still tried to take what little bits of fertile land there actually were on the reservation.
Right.
And then as much as we would love to believe that the Union were the good guys in the American Civil War, many of the Ka were forced into service.
Yeah.
In the American Civil War as scouts. And as kind of clandestine units to fight against other First Nations who had sided with, sorry, not First Nations, Indigenous Nations who had sided with
the
Confederacy, like the Cherokee and the Comanche. So, pressures from white people of European descent would eventually force the Ka out of Kansas and into the Indian territory of Oklahoma, with the official move date coming on June 4th, 1873, when they abandoned the reservation that they were on in Kansas. 2 weeks later, just 533 Ka arrived in what would become Kay County, Oklahoma, to establish the new reservation, the new Ka reservation. The nation would continue to decline over the next several years, to the point where there were only 188 individuals by 1888. And it seemed that this nation was going to face the same fate that so many others had before, and that was extinction. But despite the odds mounted against them, their numbers increased, and despite the last full-blood Ka, William Mehoja, dying in 2000, today there are more than 5,500 persons of Ka descent recognized as members of the nation. There are no full-blood Ka any longer. However, there are 5,550 plus people who are recognized as members of the nation now. So
that's cool.
Yeah. So moving on now to Manhattan itself. This city's history begins with the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened the territories to colonization in 1854. Now, to be fair, people had been colonizing it long before that. However, it was technically illegal. As of 1854, with the Kansas-Nebraska Act, it became legal to colonize the Kansas and Nebraska territories. This was when George Park founded Palestra within the modern borders of Manhattan, and then another bordering city named Canton was founded by good old Sam Houston.
Sam?
A year later, some New England Free Staters arrived, and led by Isaac Goodnow, joined Canton and Palestra together into the Free State settlement of New Boston. Now, I keep making mention of the term Free State, and this is incredibly important to understand in the history of Manhattan and the history of Kansas in general. The Kansas-Nebraska Act nullified what was known as the Missouri Compromise. The Missouri Compromise had established that all territories south of Missouri's southern border would be admitted into the Union as slave states, and all states north of Missouri's southern border would become free states. The Kansas-Nebraska Act allowed these territories to determine through popular sovereignty whether or not they would be free territories or slave territories, despite Kansas and Nebraska setting north of Missouri's southern border.
Okay.
This led to a huge number of northern abolitionists and southern racist fuckwads, supporters of slavery, to immigrate to Kansas, kicking off a precursor to the American Civil War known as Bleeding Kansas.
Oh, that was the Bloody Kansas thing.
Mm-hmm. Those who wanted Kansas to become a slave territory, aka racist fuckwads, attacked free state communities like Manhattan, hoping to run the free staters out and establish Kansas as a slave territory and offset Nebraska's decision to become a free territory. So they wanted an even number of slave and free states as the Union continued to expand. Fort Riley, which was very near Manhattan, ended up protecting the city from the worst of the Bleeding Kansas attacks. Bleeding Kansas is where John Brown first became famous.
Okay.
Before he made his way to Harper's Ferry.
Okay.
Bleeding Kansas was truly one of the bloodiest all-out conflicts of the American Civil War before the American Civil War began.
Okay.
Thousands of people died fighting to keep it a free state or to make it a slave state. It was no easy thing. This is where the term bushwhacker came from.
Uh-huh.
Rebel bushwhackers would literally hide in bushes and wait for free state transports to come through and attack them and murder everybody.
That's so gross.
And vice versa. I'm not going to say that the free staters didn't do the same thing. Because John Brown was the first American terrorist.
But if you think about it, like, kill them before they kill you type of thing.
Yeah, and it's one of those vicious cycles.
It is.
Kill them before they kill me, and then they're like, well, we got to kill him before he kills us.
But at the same time, peaceful protests, like, they will always turn into non-peaceful protests, and then...
Yeah. At the end of the day, a peaceful protest has never changed the world. The events we remember the most were the most violent. The Russian Revolution, the First World War, the Second World War, the American Civil War, the American Revolution, the French Revolution.
French Revolution, yeah.
Yeah. A peaceful protest has never substantially changed the world. Just saying.
But we're not... Anyway. We're not telling you to go fuck shit up.
Yeah. Definitely don't tear down capitalism.
Don't not do that either, though.
Listen, you do whatever feels right. We would never tell you what to do. If you've listened to this podcast since day one, you already know what we want to do.
Yeah.
And if that's what you want to do, then we support you.
Gen Z,
we see you.
Gen Z, I know it's going to be you. honeys.
I'm going to be out there with them.
No, I know.
At the end of the day.
But at the end of the day, millennials are too afraid of their, like...
Of losing everything?
No.
Of going bankrupt because of an ambulance ride?
No, like, millennials are afraid of, like, pissing off their parents or grandparents.
Yeah.
Gen Z's
like, I don't fucking need parents or grandparents.
Gives zero bucks. And I think that's kind of what we need.
Yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't go too far, though. Because I love you, Callie.
I hope it does. Fuck it.
But sometimes...
What have we got to lose at this point?
Sometimes y'all go too far. You're right. Fuck it. Burn it down. Burn to the ground. But don't do that because I don't want to be financially responsible for that because I can't afford that. Okay? Okay. Burn it down. Bye.
Carrying on. Anyway, Manhattan was protected from the worst of the Bleeding Kansas attacks, which meant that the city developed really quickly. And pretty relatively quickly, it was the second largest city in the entire state of Kansas. In 1857, the city was officially incorporated as Manhattan rather than New Boston because of some settlers from the Cincinnati Manhattan Company who had actually not intended on settling in Manhattan and were continuing upstream on the Kansas River, but their steamboat crashed. So they came back to Manhattan, New Boston, and were like, listen, okay, we'll stay here with you guys, but we gotta name it Manhattan.
Oh my god.
And so they did. And that's why it became Manhattan, Kansas.
Well, we'll see.
Throughout the rest, post-Civil War, 59ers poured through Manhattan, which we all are familiar with minor 49ers. The minor 59ers were the miners that were on their way to the gold strikes right down the road here in Idaho Springs, Colorado.
Oh.
And they were bringing huge amounts of money through the city, which further bolstered the economy. As Kansas became a state in 1861, good old Isaac Goodnow, who was then the governor of Kansas, began lobbying for Blue Mount Central College in Manhattan to become a state school. And in 1863, Kansas State Agricultural College was established as the very first land-grant institution in the entire country.
Wow.
And the second in the nation to admit men and women on equal standing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like black and white or like men and white?
No,
men and
males white. And females.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry.
They weren't quite that progressive. But it was progressive for 1863.
men and women is a step.
It was a step, yes. They were the first school in the country to have a home economics baccalaureate program in home economics for women, which... Take that for what it's worth nowadays, but at that time, that was one of the major degree programs for women to pursue was home economics. So that was a big step for colleges across the country, especially in Kansas State.
Yeah.
Manhattan further grew with the Kansas Pacific Railroad's arrival and has not stopped growing since. As I said, literally every census since Manhattan's inception, it has grown. It was named an All-American City in 1952 and consistently tops the charts for the best places to retire and to have a career.
I don't know. It's pretty cold there.
It's a bustling college town of more than 54,000 people and a forward-thinking mecca in the heart of a red state. I have always wanted to visit Manhattan primarily to watch K-State and Kansas play for the Governor's Cup and Bill Snyder Stadium, a.k.a. Farmageddon. That's what they call it, because they're both agricultural schools, which has been going on for 102 years uninterrupted, making it the longest continuous rivalry in college football, which is really cool in my opinion. I'm a college football nerd. So that's so cool.
You are?
I am, believe it or not.
I didn't know.
And I want to hear that iconic band play the Wabash Cannonball, but there's so much more to do in Manhattan. So when we go, where are we going to stay?
Guys, I just want to plug Johnny Cash on this one. He does a Wabash Cannonball.
He does indeed. Yeah.
So like you guys can hear it in its glory. What is that? Better not be white chocolate in there.
No, it's dark. I think it was a dark chocolate.
or it's a divorce.
Okay. Sorry, we're eating some golden sweets. We're going to plug them again. I'm tagging them in the post, boy.
What? So, this isn't the title of this apartment, but this is what it's titled on Google.
Okay.
Charming Hideaway.
Okay.
This vacation rental is a great spot for a couple or a family of four. The owners have renovated their home to be two apartments, but you will have the bottom portion to yourself. There's one bedroom and one bath, and in the family room there is a queen pullout, so that's where the four people come in. Who are the Wildcats? I just found out that that's Kansas State. Good for you guys. I was always thinking about, like, Kansas University?
University of Kansas, that's the Jayhawks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah.
Rock Chalk Jayhawk.
That's all. I was like, Kansas has nothing else.
Nope, they got K-State.
I went to the, actually went to the Jayhawks University.
You went to University of Kansas?
Yeah, my Aunt Leslie took me.
Really? That's really cool. In Lawrence?
Yeah.
It's beautiful there.
We went to this, like, we just went to the town and checked out
Lawrence
everything.
Is a cool little college town, but so is Manhattan, and it's just down the road.
This isn't about Lawrence.
No, it's about Manhattan.
This is about Manhattan. So anyway, the Wildcats, they're Kansas State. In case you guys didn't already know that. Okay. I'm not sure, but I feel... Oh, nope. I already went over this. The Kansas State University is only 3 miles from this location, so if you are a fan, this is a great place to stay because you can take just a short drive there.
Yeah, for sure.
Or walk. Whatever. There's a kitchenette with modern amenities, as well as a crock pot, coffee pot, and other gadgets to make your stay more like home away from home. Another major bonus is that they have the cutest little patio. They have the cutest little patio set up for you to enjoy day or night with an outdoor 4-person table.
Nice.
I love how the apartment is decorated, and I'm sure you will too. So check them out on Google. Once again, Charming Hideaway, Kansas, Manhattan, Kansas.
So though most of us don't think about much recreation in Kansas, this is actually a really beautiful area in the Flint Hills and the tall grass prairies of Kansas. It's an area that was incredibly important to the foundation of the country that we know now. But I'm going to send you to a place that's just north of Manhattan, and this is a 19 square mile impoundment of the Big Blue River, forming the absolutely beautiful Tuttle Creek Reservoir. And there's not just one park to send you to here, because there are several different state parks around this lake, but one of the best is Tuttle Creek State Park. Along the southern end of the reservoir, this park protects some 1,200 acres of recreational lands, boasting hundreds of primitive and modern campgrounds, as well as several nature trails, mountain biking trails, equestrian trails, a shooting range, a beach, docks. This park is perfect. It's beautiful. It's nestled in the Flint Hills and is absolutely just a great place to spend a relaxing day on the shores of the lake and take in the beauty of this part of Kansas. There's tons of wildlife and natural beauty, as well as many typical state park activities like fishing, water recreation, hiking, just great things like that. So I truly think you should visit if you make your way to Manhattan. So if you would like to learn a little bit more, be sure to visit ksoutdoors.com/stateparks/locations/Tuttle-Creek. That's T-U-T-T-L-E. They are about as good as coding as the National Forest Service is.
So A little better.
So what fun things are we going to do in Manhattan?
So our first stop is the Flint Hills Discovery Center. This is an interactive science, culture, and history museum. The exhibit shows different layers of the prairie, which is slowly becoming one of the few left in the United States.
Very true.
The Farmers Market, which is downtown and has been going on every Saturday since 1979, probably not since COVID, but it's Kansas, so maybe. I don't know.
Who knows?
About 40 vendors are located there, and they each bring a variety of product from from fruits, vegetables, baked goods, and even jewelry to soap.
Okay.
This is a great place to meet local artists and growers, so make sure you check that out if you're there on the weekend. The Kansas State Insect Zoo, which is slowly becoming popular in this podcast, insect zoos.
I love some entomology.
An old dairy barn inverted, just fell right in.
It just imploded. Straight inside out.
Converted into an insect zoo. They have live specimen and even fossilized insects, as well as microscopes to check out the teeny tiny ones that you may not be able to see with the naked eye. Liquid Art Winery and Estate. Here, you will see lines and lines of grapes growing in their glory. Try out one of their tastings and sample rooms and some of their award-winning wines. You can also check out some of their hard ciders if wine really isn't your bag, which is, it's not mine, but I'd probably drink some wine.
Yeah.
And some cider.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried?
I love cider.
Yeah. I actually like wine if it's, you know, done right.
Same. Yeah.
Doesn't have to be expensive. It just has to taste good.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, for me.
Same. So next I have Sunset Zoo. This is where you can check out one of the oldest zoos in the country. It was established in the 1930s by Kansas State University Head of Surgery and Medicine, Dr. E.J. Frick.
Nice.
The zoo spans over 26 acres, giving the animals plenty of room to roam. And then I have the Wildwood Adventure Park. The park has 7 zip lines and free fall courses to enjoy. But the kids, you know, they gotta be over 50 pounds because it's not safe. And they like a 280 pound max, I think. Fair. Which, get some stronger zip lines, you wimps. This is America. We like to eat here. But yeah, that's what I have for fun things to do.
Okay, well, speaking of eating, I'm going to send you to a wonderful little restaurant in Manhattan that actually has 2 locations. And therefore, my recommendation is never going to be far away. Early Edition is a unique little restaurant specializing in breakfast offerings, but don't let that fool you. It's open all day long. Mm-hmm. Plus, they offer way more than just breakfast, like the Wildcat Sandwich, which is smoked turkey, bacon, pepper jack cheese, and ranch on sourdough, and mouth-watering burgers like the Avocado Ranch Burger. You're definitely going to find something amazing to eat, and you're going to enjoy the small-town diner atmosphere. They also have a kids' menu if you got sticky-fingered trash goblins with you.
Now we can say trash goblins. Okay. That was edited out a year ago.
I'll probably edit this out.
No, fine.
But my point is, you're going to have fun, and you're going to find some great food at Early Edition, so be sure to check them out at earlyeditionrestaurant.com. So now it's Beerapalooza time.
Beerapalooza.
Perfect. That's what I was hoping you would
do. I sounded like a chicken.
A little bit.
Close to what I was going to.
I'm still happy about it.
I was going for a pheasant.
Oh, okay. Basically a prairie chicken.
I wasn't going for a pheasant. I don't know what they sound like.
I don't mean, yeah, I mean, I do, yeah.
No,
it's that's a quail.
What do quail sound like?
I don't know for sure about quail.
I thought they had like a little purr.
But.
I went quail hunting with my dad once.
Pheasants are like, almost like chickens. They're like, almost like a guinea.
I knew it. I
don't know. But anyway. One of the newest breweries in the city is hoping to reshape craft beer culture in Manhattan, and that is, of course, Manhattan Brewing Company. With more than 20 years of brewing experience, Adam, Garrett, and Jake have created something very special in downtown, and they're ready to share it with the world. With a beautiful tap room nestled right in the heart of the city, this place is definitely worth the stop. They offer a wide range of beers like the light and crisp Towny Wheat Ale, and heavy hitters like Macho Double IPA. And then all the way to mouth-puckering sours like the dry-hopped Hoppy Sour. My point is they have a very great space in downtown, in the beautiful city of Manhattan, and you can sip an outstanding beer while visiting with some locals and learning a little bit more about the town. So if you would like to visit Manhattan Brewing Company, be sure to check them out at mhkbeer.com. And with that, we've spent 42 minutes almost on this intro segment, so we're going to move on to Lakin's story after the break. All right, so we're back, and that means it's time for Lakin to lead us out with her story. Hers is not necessarily true crime this week. Neither of our stories really are, but we discussed it ahead of time, and we agreed that we'll finish off with mine. So lead us out, my dear.
Okay. I titled this St. Mary's Guess. My name is Ingrid, and I have worked at St. Mary's Hospital for what seems like a lifetime. The building was built in 1907, and I've been a nurse here since it opened. I work at night, to which I prefer, more so than the day. My duties here are simple. Carry food trays to the infirm and tend to those who wake in pain or otherwise. Much has changed over the years. They've put in electricity, but I still prefer candlelight. They've put in an elevator, but I've only used it a few times. Now that I think about it, I haven't taken the elevator in quite some time. The rare occasion that I did before, I'd hold my breath on it until I'd reached the top. That rickety thing terrifies me. Many years have gone by. My fellow nurse's uniform changes, but mine stays the same. I very much like to keep traditions here. That's why I keep my candle with me at night as well. The only time I really talk to the other nurses is if I have to pass on information about a patient. It's not at all like the camaraderie I once had with the first set of nurses that ran this place. The newer nurses act as if I'm not here. They must think I'm too old or too old-fashioned, but it does get lonely from time to time. Sometimes when rounding a corner at night, I can give a few of the girls quite a fright. On occasion, while rounding a corner a bit too fast, I'll come across another nurse. They never see me coming until I'm right in front of their noses, and sometimes I get a gasp or even a little shriek. I'm thankful to have one friend here. His name is George, and George keeps it lively around here. George came here a frail old man, but I must say his stay here has really done him some good. He looks much younger now and is more energetic than ever. I've never visited his room before, mostly because he's never in it. He's always roaming the hallways, shutting the lights on and off to mess with the other nurses. Some days, I have to remind George that he is in a hospital and he can't be making all this racket. He's constantly tinkering away at things, fixing broken clocks and other electrical things that I cannot begin to understand. Once the whole city's block electricity went out due to a powerful storm that blew through. George had an absolute fit, ranting and raving about how will he ever watch his program on the television when it isn't working. He was determined to watch Star Trek, and he, by golly, did. He managed to fix the hospital's power, but left the rest of the block for someone else to do. Because he had a program to watch. And that was Star Trek. It is much quieter around here now. The doctors and nurses have gone, but George and I, we keep this place alive. The occasional tour will come through talking about hauntings in the building. Speaking of the nurse who died in an elevator shaft, But I have no time for silly rumors. I have work to do. While Ingrid's name was a bit of my imagination, the spirit of the nurse is still very real. Her death came about when she was on duty late at night. She thought the elevator to be on her floor and backed into the shaft, pulling her cart behind her, and thought she fell to her death. People see her walking the halls in her classic nurse's uniform, holding a tray, a candle, always lighting the way. The spirit, George, was once a patient of the hospital as well. No, I just made that up. Shit. The spirit, George, was once a patient of the hospital. George was an elderly man who met an abrupt end when he fell between the wall and his bed. George is known for making a lot of noise throughout the hospital, sounding almost like tinkering, but he mostly sticks to the third floor. But that can be banging
right
on pipes as well. He does have a sense of humor, though. He loves to lock and unlock doors, flicking the lights on and off. All those ghostly stuffs. Everyone that has encountered George thinks that he is very friendly. He has been known to make a few repairs around the building, and it really is believed that he fixed the hospital's power one stormy night. People will often come into a room on the third floor that hadn't been used that day to find a TV on blaring Star Trek. The building has played a few different roles other than a hospital. For a few years, it was a fraternity, and then it was a retirement home. It is believed that when the nurse finally figured out that the building she haunted was no longer a hospital, she moved on. But not before she gave a few frat boys a good scare. It seems that George hasn't moved on, though, but people really don't mind his presence there. After all, if another storm blows through, who will fix the power?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Okay, good. I'm good.
I got chills at the end of the nurse's tale there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was good. I like that.
Thank you. You know, I don't do that stuff.
And now you're not, I know you're not
imaginary stuff.
Dig into the creative writing, but I think you did very well. And I hope everybody else enjoyed it. So with that, we're going to take a brief sponsor break. And we'll be back with my story. So we're back. And it's time for me to tell my story. And the title of that story is Black Friday. Manhattan sets at the intersection of the Big Blue River and the Kansas River. Anyone who has or does live in a river town is acutely aware of the hazards that are associated with close proximity to a conduit for nature's most powerful and destructive force, water. In the spring, almost as reliably as the changing of the seasons, floods come to rivers. And the Kansas River is no exception to that rule. Occasionally, that annual flooding reaches epic proportions, leaving devastation and death in its path. For centuries, man has hoped to contain rivers and prevent water from destroying all that we have built. From levee systems to lock and dams to impoundments of waterways, we have constructed some of the most interesting and unique methods of holding back the destructive force of water. But each time we build a little bit higher, a touch stronger, or just a hair bigger, believing that this is the creation that will finally hold the floods back, nature reminds us we exist solely at her discretion. The Kansas River begins outside of Junction City, where the Smoky Hill and the Republican Rivers meet. The Smoky Hill River traverses the entire state and begins clear back in Cheyenne Wells, Colorado. On its journey through Kansas, it's fed by a number of smaller tributaries, one of those being Big Creek, which runs through Hays, Kansas. And this is where our story begins. Big Creek is just that, a big creek. In 1951, there were no levees along the creek, no dams, no flood control. It simply hadn't been necessary. Then in May of 51, a massive storm pushed across Kansas. In Hays, 11 inches of rain fell in just 2 hours. One of the fastest accumulations of precipitation on record. Big Creek became a raging torrent. There were no early warning systems in Hays. Of course, people knew the storm was dumping a whole lot of rain, but they didn't know what was coming. Some residents that lived upstream from the community made it to town to warn the police of what was coming as Big Creek began to swell. Two police officers got in their cars and drove along low-lying streets late in the night, blaring their sirens and screaming out their windows to evacuate. One can almost imagine the scene. The darkened streets of Hays lit by the flashing lights of police cars. The air filled with the sound of the unrelenting rainstorm, the sirens, and the desperate pleas of the soaking wet officers for residents to get to higher ground. Though these officers saved so many lives, so many more just didn't have the time to get out. A 4-foot wall of water blasted into downtown Hays, sweeping buildings off their foundations and claiming countless lives. Fort Hays State University was in the path of this flood. In the middle of the night, hundreds of students fled the dorms for the higher setting of the stadium. But even that wasn't high enough. The floodwaters continued to climb, pushing the co-eds higher and higher in the stadium until they were confined to the third floor, the only portion that was not inundated with mud and water from Big Creek. The tide of water that pushed through Big Creek eventually made its way to Smoky Hill River, and the rains kept coming. Into July, record-setting rainfalls pushed across Kansas time and time again. From Great Bend to Manhattan, the rains just kept coming. Half a dozen years earlier, Congress had approved a plan to build the Tuttle Creek Dam north of Manhattan, I mentioned that earlier, along the Big Blue River, to aid, in theory, in flood control. But nothing had come of that yet, other than some earthwork. Then between July 9th and the 13th, the heaviest periods of rain with 8 to 16 inches soaking the tall grass prairies, landscapes that were not designed to take this kind of rainfall, finally came. The July 13th crest in Manhattan began along the Smoky Hill River near Fort Riley, and also north along Big Blue. Both rivers were at their breaking points, and both were dumping directly into the Kansas River that skirts downtown Manhattan, which sat directly in the bullseye. The fact is, we don't actually know what the crest of the river was. It topped all of the flood gauges along the Kansas River that were established at that time, as it pushed into downtown Manhattan. Modern estimates place the flooding at around 16 feet above flood stage.
Oh, God.
Reports state that the business district of Manhattan, closest to the river, was covered in 8 feet of mud and water from the Kansas River.
Holy shit. 8 feet.
Yeah. Though metrics and estimations may not provide an accurate picture of how bad the flood was, the stories of the people who were there do. Earlier in 1951, The governor of Kansas had ordered that K-State develop a civil defense strategy. Now, undoubtedly, this was more as a result of the Red Scare than a planning for any sort of natural disaster. It was likely that the intention of this strategy was to prepare for a nuclear attack from the Soviets, but the unintended consequences tie directly into this story. You see, on July 13th, as tens of thousands of cubic feet of water rushed down the Big Blue and Kansas rivers towards their confluence at Manhattan, it would not be first responders or even residents of Manhattan that would step up in the most substantial ways to save that city. It would be the students of K-State.
Oh, gooseies.
K-State had installed backup generators to ensure electricity in the event of a grid failure, which meant that the university would be the only place in the city with power when the flood hit.
Oh.
As 1 million acres of land flooded, 2,500 homes, 336 businesses were demolished, and a further 25,000 homes and businesses were covered by 8-plus feet of water and mud. K-State was dry-ish, at least. Dry enough to stand as the only respite from the devastation. And to boot, they had electricity. Students piled into pickup trucks and National Guard personnel carriers to begin the days-long tasks of saving people stranded by the floods.
Oh, I'm not crying. I guess I'm not Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Just a few miles east of Manhattan, residents of Zinndale, Kansas, stood on the only dry spot in town, a railroad bridge, and watched as their homes and businesses were swept away by the unrelenting waters. Not a single structure stood in the city. People were stranded on the tops of homes in Manhattan, huddled together, hoping beyond all hope that their homes would not be the next to dislodge from its foundation and be carried away, even as their neighbors' houses slammed into their own. It was quite literally a scene from a disaster movie, the likes of which nobody alive at that time had ever experienced. But Savior did come in the form of a newfangled contraption called the helicopter. The United States Coast Guard deployed the one helicopter that they had available at that time to the Manhattan area, using Memorial Stadium, where the K-State Wildcats play, as its staging point. It flew out, scooping up families off of their flooded homes and brought them back to the K-State facility. It flew out time and time again, scooping up families off of their flooded homes and bringing them back to the K-State faculty and students who were stepping up to be the saviors of the city.
Wow.
The university became the epicenter of the community, with the campus kitchens working in overdrive to provide food for nearly 2,800 people, not counting students and staff, who were using the campus and surrounding community as temporary homes. Faculty, sororities, and fraternities opened their doors to more than 1,000 refugees from the flood.
I bet it was St. Mary's. I bet St. Mary's was one of them.
Probably.
Because this was the time.
Yeah. Summer classes were canceled and the entire campus was opened up, with each department providing different services to those affected. Ahern Fieldhouse became a tent city, with families sleeping on cots crammed throughout the facility, walled off by sheets. But in the days after the waters returned to their normal levels, the threat was far from over. Flies and mosquitoes bred in mass on the corpses of dead animals and breeding in the stagnant waters. K-State was ready for this too. Lafine Health Center and local doctors organized a mass typhoid fever vaccination program and students worked with the National Guard and Fire Department to hose down the entire city, clearing away as much mud and carcasses as they could.
Oh my God, good on them, you know?
Right. Roger Smith, the head of the entomology department, developed a plan and a pesticide that could be sprayed throughout the entire city to kill off the disease-spreading insects. The student union at the university became the nerve center for the entire city. City Hall was relocated here, and the National Guard headquarters was set up there as well.
Wow.
In all, 2,251 families were directly affected in Manhattan by the Great Flood of 1951. $13.4 million worth of damage was assessed to Manhattan alone. And Manhattan was not the only city affected by this flood. Topeka, Grand Junction, all of them. That's $144.9 million in today's money. More than 60% of the city sat under 8-plus feet of water. 28 people lost their lives in the flood. A substantially lower number than it could have been. And it is without a doubt that the efforts of Kansas State University, its faculty, and its students saved countless lives on Black Friday.
And to think, like, they had these measures in order for the Red Scare.
Right.
But this time, it worked out because they were ready.
Yeah.
For.
And the thing was, though, that, like, these mitigation plans they had in effect didn't actually involve students.
Yeah.
It was never supposed to involve students. But the students just, like, stepped up.
You know what? Good for them. And I feel like there still would be today.
Yeah.
But that's huge. Like, and, like, the people, like, the doctor, the entomologist.
Yeah.
We listen to them. We don't listen to them now.
Right.
But
they're all just quacks that don't know what they're talking about now. But
like, we listened to them, and for that, it could have been a lot worse.
So much worse.
Yeah.
There could have been mass yellow fever and typhoid fever outbreaks in the city.
Yeah.
And malaria.
Which it's kind of weird to think about, like, even at this time, like, yellow fever being, like, a mass outbreak.
Yeah. In a moment of terror and disaster, average people, teenagers, 20-somethings, stepped up and did what had to be done for a community that ultimately wasn't even technically theirs. They put themselves at risk. They put themselves at risk and thought not of what was in it for them. There's a great deal of inspiration that can be found in the innumerable selfless acts of July 13th, 1951, and the weeks that followed that. This date is seared into the collective memory of the city of Manhattan. 71 years later, Black Friday is still not forgotten. And I hope that when the day comes that any one of you is faced with such a disaster and in the position to help, you'll put your own needs aside and help your fellow man. Because without compassion and selflessness, what are we truly good for?
Oof. I have gooses.
It was just such an inspirational story to me. Just like reading about all these students that just like
did it.
Piled in pickup trucks and just were like, let's help people get their furniture out of their houses. Let's get them out of their houses. Let's fucking wade chest deep in flood water to save children, like,
right?
It's just wild.
Yeah. And selfless, like,
yeah,
sometimes it's hard to think about college kids being selfless, like, But at the same time, society,
even,
like...
And in reality, not just college kids, because there's just, like... Especially, it feels like now more so than ever, we live in a society that is just so inundated with this thought process that if it doesn't benefit you, you shouldn't be doing it.
Right.
You got to look out for number one. Humankind has never, we have never survived by looking out for the individual. That is not how our species evolved. That is not how we survived the early days. That's not how we ever survived.
Yeah.
We always survived by banding together and doing what was best for everybody.
Right.
I mean, even some of the pivotal points in human history were the American Revolution was people banding together and deciding this is what's best for all of us. Let's do it.
Right.
It was never about, you know, themselves. You know, the French Revolution was not about individual enrichment. It was about what they thought was best for the nation as a whole.
Yeah, and, you know, they were starving.
Well, I mean, yeah, but they were starving, so they're like, all right, let's overthrow the monarchy. Starving. Yeah, we're all starving. Let's overthrow the monarchy, and maybe we won't starve anymore.
Yeah.
But, like, not even so much that, just, like, our history in general, human history has always been about working collectively. Yeah. Now that's socialism and that's scary. But in reality,
it's always
we
been
don't it. Survive.
If we don't work together.
We don't survive through individualism. That is a concept that has been sold to us.
Yeah.
For the past 180 years. It's been pushed on us and sold to us that you have to, individualism's important. You have to work for yourself. You have to do what's best for you because no one else is going to do what's best for you. That's not true. We all work together. Just like the students at K-State did. Just like Manhattan did. Just like every time we face a major disaster, people band together and do what's best. Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
The flood of 93, the flood of 2008. Like, my friends and I were on the levees throwing sandbags in 2008.
Yeah.
Not because, I didn't live in the flood plains
area. No.
My house was always going to be fine.
Right.
I went to the levees because I knew people whose houses weren't going to be fine.
Right.
And it benefited me in no way to be there. Other than, I mean, there's no such thing as a selfless act, I know. Because. Right. Yes, I felt good about what I did.
But
I felt good about what I did, not because it directly benefited me, but because I knew that good thing I did that I felt good about helped other people.
Right.
Other people that, at the end of the day, if their house washed away, there was never going to be a dime out of my pocket for that.
Right.
You know?
Right. Listen, you're preaching to the choir.
I know. I'm,
because you know me, I'm learning to be less selfless. Selfless in healthy ways.
Right.
Because you can give and give and give to people and,
well, and
give everything. But at the end of the day, like, you, I don't know, like, you do it for not just you. No, I did it for not just me. I did it to help people.
I mean, don't wholly sacrifice your own personal health personal mental health or personal safety for nothing. But if an entire community pulls together for something, everybody benefits from that.
And how amazing is it for everyone to get together, like people that don't get along? Families that don't get along.
Right.
And kids, teenagers, college students.
Yeah.
You know, who didn't necessarily all like each other. They all went together.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, and at the end of the day, if we don't pull together for the best interest of our communities and our states and our country, then our individual... Your individual benefit is not going to exist.
No.
There will be no individual enrichment if everything else crumbles down.
Right.
That's why collectivism is a good thing. That's why working collectively is a positive thing.
Right.
You know. But anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. I just thought that was such an amazing story that really pulled at my heartstrings, and I thought it was like a good note to end the episode on.
Yeah.
With like just how inspirational that was. Like
it was. Amazing. Especially for college students.
Yeah, and these were kids who didn't even, Manhattan was not their home.
Yeah.
You know, they're from all over the country and they still
put themselves
at risk to save other people. To save their community.
Good for you.
Yeah.
You saved how many people?
Probably thousands of people were saved from the efforts of the student and faculty at K-State.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way of knowing for sure.
Right.
But only 28 people died in a flood. Of the worst floods in the history of the state of Kansas.
Yeah.
Only 28 people died in Manhattan.
And it could have been much worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But anyway, Manhattan is a little bit off the interstate. You have to get off of Interstate 70 and head north just a ways. And it's a beautiful little area that you're definitely going to have to check out. Because as that last story tells you, there are some great people in Manhattan. So you're going to meet some of those while you're there.
You're probably going to go to a lot of great restaurants.
For sure. You're definitely going to go on some awesome adventures.
You're definitely going to You're grating some good beer. You're going to drink some good beer.
And hopefully,
these are the places you'll go.